thing we have to fear is...
In war, fear itself. There is no substitute for victory.
Let us never negotiate out of fear.
We stand undivided, forever united, fighting hand in hand for the liberty we burn, for glory and honor, for our sons and daughters, ever mindful of the lessons we've learned. Let the torch of freedom burn.
Welcome to the intersection of faith and politics. This is Wallbuilders Live with David Barton and Rick Green. You can visit us online at wallbuilders.com and also wallbuilderslive.com. By the way, at wallbuilders.com, a wealth of information there. Tons of articles and great information you can get right there on the website. And then, of course, the DVDs and books and CDs and actually all the writings of several of the founding fathers available on CD-ROMs, where you can access those right there on your computer. Just incredible information there. Go check it out at wallbuilders.com. Then at wallbuilderslive.com, that's our radio website, you can get a list of all of our stations, and you can also get our archived programs. I bring that up because today you're actually tuning in to part three of a four-part series on biblical principles and the political process. And so if you missed part one and part two, they're available on our website right now at wallbuilderslive.com. Just click on the archive button, and that'll take you to several programs over the last several months, including yesterday and the day before, where we started this series. This is a new DVD by David Barton. It's one of those topics that a lot of people say, biblical principles, politics, those don't mix. But in fact, the Bible has an awful lot to say about politics, and this DVD explains that in a very powerful way. So we're going to pick up where we left off. This will be part three in a four-part series. Here's David Barton on biblical principles and the political process.
Your kids depend on having the right kind of people in office. If you don't get the right kind of people in office, you need to understand that'll affect your welfare and especially the welfare of your kids. And we understood that politics, our family was really downstream from politics. And that's the emphasis they put, and that really is the right emphasis, and that's proven by God as well. Matter of fact, if you look at the three institutions in the Bible, you start with marriage, man and a woman, then comes civil government, then comes the church. The second institution that God created was civil government. He created that before he created the church. So this is an important institution to God. That's why he tells us in 1 Timothy to pray first of all for government and those in authority. He didn't say pray for your family church first, your church first, pray for your business. He said you pray for government first. That's pretty high importance to God to put that the first thing you pray for every day. So we've got to get that back in our thinking. I don't care about government. All I care about is my family, my job. No. God says, first of all, you need to be praying for government because it affects your family, it affects your business, it affects everything else you do. There's no way around that. So going back to this, how does the church deal with this? Well, interesting, there's a lot of history on this. You go back into American history, and you find that the church played a very key role. Let's go back to the American Revolution as a starting place. The American Revolution, back at the start, the first major skirmish we had in the American Revolution was there at Lexington Green. Lexington, then Concord, then the road back to Charleston. Well, there at Lexington, it was not a very pretty picture. You had 70 Americans taking on 700 British. At the end of that skirmish, you had 18 Americans laying on the ground, no British on the ground. It's not an auspicious start. But it's interesting, they were, those 70 guys and those 18 that were lying there, by the way, it was both black patriots and white patriots. Black patriots like Prince Estabrook, white patriots like John Robbins, they're all laying there. And the interesting thing about them is they were all out of the same church. Their pastor was the Reverend Jonas Clark, who said, I have trained my church for this very hour. It was his church that went out there to defend the town from the onslaught of the British. And how come they didn't shoot any British? Because he had taught them, he says, the Bible makes it very clear that God will not bless an offensive war. You can't start this. He said, but God will bless self-defense. If they shoot at you, you can shoot back. Well, they get the first shot, 700 shots before we shoot back. That's not a good deal. That's why 18 hit the ground. We're allowed to defend ourselves. We're not allowed to start something. That's why the Founding Fathers went 11 years through reconciliation, doing everything they could. Even after we've been firing bullets for 6 years, they're still trying to reconcile with Great Britain, the Olive Branch Petition, all the things, because they don't want to start anything. Now, if the other side starts it, which Great Britain did, sent 25,000 troops to our efforts to reconcile, Olive Branch Petition gets 25,000 troops. Once they start shooting, we can shoot back because it's self-defense at that point. But that was done by a pastor. The pastor takes his church out there to defend the town. And then when you get to Concord next, you have the Reverend Emerson out there with his church defending there at North Bridge. So you have pastors leading the way all over this. The same in New Jersey. A leader of forces in New Jersey was the Reverend James Caldwell. This happens to be a battle outside the Presbyterian Church in the Battle of Springfield. There's Reverend Caldwell over in the doorway passing out the wadding to his troops. You have in Virginia, you have folks like the Reverend John Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg. He's out of Woodstock, Virginia. In January of 1776, he preached a sermon to his congregation. He said, guys, we came to this country to practice our liberties, and if we don't get involved, we're going to lose our liberties. And so in his congregation right there in front, he tore off his clerical robes that morning and revealed the full dress uniform officer under it. Now, it's black. This is where we get black robe regiments. All the preachers back then wore that black robe. And so it was those guys who led. So here he is taking off the robe. He says, all right, who's going with me to defend our liberties? 300 men got up from that church. They became the 8th Virginia Regiment. The evidence of them still exists throughout the Revolution. If you go to Valley Forge, you'll still see at Valley Forge, the Muhlenberg Barracks there at Valley Forge. That's his church. That's his pastor leading his church out. And there they are at Valley Forge. He becomes one of the highest ranking military officers in the American Revolution. He's there with George Washington, surrender at Yorktown. He's Major General John Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg. He's a preacher. What's he doing involved? Well, we weren't just involved on the military side of things. We're also involved in education. You look at what Christians did. Every university started in the early founding was started by Christians to be able to teach good knowledge, good information. And even if you look ahead to 1860, now we're 240 years after the first attempted founding of the university. By 1860, we have 246 colleges in America. And even a century after the American founding, 91% of all college presidents were gospel ministers. I don't think 91% of Christian colleges have gospel ministers leading the day. But this was state universities. I mean, the church was involved in everything going on, in education and military, even in politics. A great historian, J.T. Headley, said this. He says, the patriotic clergy of the Revolution were the soundest statesmen of the time. The best political thinkers out there were the preachers. Really? Well, you remember back when they signed the Declaration and they wiped out all those 13 governments and the Founding Fathers themselves went home and started writing state constitutions. It's interesting to see who else helped them write the state constitutions. Preacher after preacher is involved in writing those original state constitutions, 1776, 1780, all those constitutions. It was Founding Fathers and preachers because the preachers were the able statesmen.
This is David Barton with another moment from America's history. Today, numerous court decisions demonstrate that there's often a conflict between the courts, the law, and religion. Has this conflict always existed? Not according to James Wilson. James Wilson was a signer of both the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. He was a law professor as well as an original justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. James Wilson saw no conflict between religion and the law. In fact, just the contrary. He declared, human law must rest its authority ultimately upon the authority of that law which is divine. Far from being rivals or enemies, religion and law are twin sisters, friends, and mutual assistants. Indeed, these two sciences run into each other. In the views of Founding Father James Wilson, religion and good civil law were inseparable.
For more information on God's hand in American history, contact Wall Builders at 1-800-8-REBUILD.
Let the torch of freedom burn.
After you get done with all the state governments, you eventually win the revolution. Now you go on to the U.S. Constitution and you write the U.S. Constitution. But you got to get ratified. It doesn't mean anything until all 13 states or at least the majority of them ratify it. So if you're going to have a ratification convention for a political document like the Constitution, where do you send it? Oh, you got to send it to state capital, right? No. If you're in states like Massachusetts, if you're in states like North Carolina, they had the ratification conventions in the churches. That's where they met to ratify the Constitution. In churches? Yeah, and in those states you had to elect specific delegates to ratify the Constitution. You couldn't just show up. You had to have an elected delegate that's been sent there to ratify for or against the Constitution. 41 of those delegates were ministers of the gospel. They were elected by their states to be the ones to make the decision on whether we wanted this Constitution or not. I mean, the preachers are the best political leaders out there in the day. We don't think of it that way anymore, but that's the way it had been. And then after the Constitution does come in place, we convene the first federal Congress, and in that first federal Congress, we do the Bill of Rights. Great document. The Bill of Rights gives us those 10 amendments that are our fundamental rights. It's interesting to see the signature at the bottom of the Bill of Rights. This is a key document in American history. You see the signature, John Adams, Vice President, and Frederick Augustus. Who in the world is Frederick Augustus Muhlenberg? Well, he is the Reverend Frederick Augustus Muhlenberg. The first Speaker of the House of Representatives was a preacher of the gospel, and it's amazing how many preachers were elected in that first Congress, the guys who did our Bill of Rights. So all the way through, the church has been involved in this process. Now, this is back in the American founding, and this is the way it had been, but this is why John Adams, who was an eyewitness to all this, he said, you know, the great thing about what's happened here, he says, our pulpits have thundered. He says, we have addressed every single issue that's come up. And that's where the British named these guys the Black Robe Regiment. The British said if it hadn't been for those guys wearing the black robes, if it hadn't been for all those preachers, America would still be a happy British colony. Well, they targeted the preachers. That's why when they landed in, when the British came into New York in 1777, there were 19 churches in town. They burned and desecrated all 19 of them. They burned 10 to the ground, desecrated 9 others. They went across Maine burning churches, across New Jersey burning churches, across Virginia burning churches. They targeted churches because it was the preachers, it was the churches who were the leaders in all these things. That was the American model. And so when you move forward to someone like Charles Fanny, by the way, we still have it going today with the National Black Robe Regiment, a national movement where preachers have said, you know, it's time for us to be an influence in the community again. We got to stand up and do something here. So there's information on nationalblackroberegiment.com on the revival of this. But if you take the American model and move forward to someone like Charles Finney, Charles Finney is part of the Second Great Awakening. But Charles Finney grew up listening to the speeches of President George Washington, President John Adams, President Thomas Jefferson. He knew all that early American stuff. And so with preachers in his generation, this is when we're going through all the abolition years that lead up to the Civil War and the years after the Civil War where we're fighting for equal rights. He's very involved in all that. And this is what he told preachers in his day. He was very blunt. He said, look, guys, we have a model. This is the way we've always done it in America. He says, brethren, our preaching will bear its legitimate. No question about it. The pulpit has a huge impact. Our preaching will bear its legitimate fruits. He said, but on the other hand, he says, if immorality prevails in the land, the fault's ours in a large degree. If the land is immoral, it's because we're not doing our job as the church. We're not being out there where we should. We're not influencing what we should. He says, and if there's decay of conscience, the pulpit's responsible for it because we haven't taught conscience the way we should. We haven't elected people to office who understand the rights of conscience. He says, and if the public press lacks moral discrimination, the pulpit's responsible for it. Why would we have anything to do with public press? Because we had so trained people to think biblically that they wouldn't buy all that secular garbage out there. You know, they're not going to waste their money on that. They didn't even have the right viewpoint. Now we don't train in biblical thinking, and so all we know is what the secular press tells us, and so that's what we buy. But that's because the church is not addressing the issues it always addressed. He continues. He says, if the church is degenerate and worldly, the pulpit's responsible for it. They wouldn't fall for temptation if the church was teaching the right thing. He continues. He says, if the world loses its interest in religion, the pulpit's responsible for it. He continues. He says, and if Satan rules in our halls of legislation, the pulpit's responsible. Whoa, time out. Why is the church responsible for what happens in Washington, D.C., or in the state capitol, or in city, or... Because, again, we represent 78% of the nation, and we're only voting at 2% in city elections. That's our fault. That's not their fault. That's our fault for not being. And look what else he says. He says, Satan rules in our halls of legislation, pulpit's responsible for it. He says, and if our politics become so corrupt that the very foundations of our government are ready to fall away, the pulpit's responsible for it. Wow. But see, that's because the church has that influence. God gave them that influence. We just haven't exercised it. But what's the solution for having Satan rule in our halls of legislation and have government so corrupt that the foundations fall? What do we do to solve that? Well, the solution to that actually is found in a biblical teaching that occurs in Judges 9. In Judges chapter 9, you have the parable of the trees of the field. And what happened, all the trees of the field got together and said, we need a civic leader. We need a ruler. We got to elect a president, if you will. We got to elect a governor. We got to elect a mayor, whatever. So the trees got together, and this is what the Bible tells us. It says, one day the trees went out to anoint a ruler for themselves. And so what the trees did, they went right off to the olive tree, and they said to the olive tree, be our leader. But the olive tree answered and said, absolutely no way. I'm not going to get involved in politics. The olive tree said, should I give up my oil by which both gods and men are honored to hold sway over the trees? You can count me out. So they went next to the fig tree, and they said to the fig tree, oh, come be our ruler. But the fig tree replied, said, absolutely no, I'm not getting involved in that stuff.
This is David Barton with another moment from America's history. Our founding fathers, despite their common love for America, did not always agree with each other in politics. Such was the case between John and Samuel Adams. John was the leader of the Federalist Party, and Samuel was the leader of the Anti-Federalist Party. Consequently, political disagreements were not unusual between these two. On October the 4th, 1790, Sam wrote John and told him, "Let ministers and philosophers, statesmen and patriots, unite their endeavors to renovate the age by educating their little boys and girls and leading them in the study and practice of the exalted virtues of the Christian system." 2 weeks later, John wrote back and told Samuel that on this issue, they both agreed. While these two prominent founding fathers disagreed on much, they both agreed on the importance of educating the next generation in the principles of Christianity.
For more information on God's hand in American history, contact Wall Builders at 1-800-8-REBUILD.
The fig tree said, should I give up my fruits, so good and sweet, to hold sway over the trees? Count me out. I'm not getting involved in that stuff. So next they went to the vine, and they said to the vine, come be our leader. And the vine said, no, I'm not about to get into that. The vine said, should I give up my wine, which cheers both gods and men, to hold sway over the trees? Now notice what's happened here. They want a leader, and they've gone to all the good guys, all the good trees, all the productive folks, all the folks that do all the right, and they said, we want you to be our leader. And all of them had good reasons why they couldn't do it. You know, my business is doing too well, and I got too much going at home, and I got too much going at church. And so they all had reasons why they couldn't be the ones to be the leader. And at that point, what happened? It says, the trees of the field, finally, all the trees said to the thorn bush, that doesn't sound like a good option. I mean, we've had some good options, but they've all turned it down. So now we're talking about a thorn bush, and I'm not quite sure that I'm going to enjoy the fruit from being under a thorn bush. It says, finally, they said to the thorn bush, come be our leader. And wouldn't you know it? The thorn bush says, I'd be happy to. Man, I've always wanted to be a leader. And now you got a thorn bush for real. And notice the thorn bush says, hey, if you really want to anoint me a leader, have you come take refuge in my shade? Just what kind of enjoyment is it to sit under the shade of a thorn bush? And what kind of fruit do you enjoy? But see, this is the problem America has right now. We got way too many thorn bushes ruling. And we have thorn bushes ruling because the good guys refuse to do anything about it. Well, it's so corrupt. Well, it's corrupt because you don't get involved in it. It's corrupt because you let the thorn bushes have it all. So thorn bushes are ruling. And, you know, it's interesting. I think I can easily prove that statistically. Groups like Intercollegiate Studies Institute, they measure citizenship and how much citizens know about their country. And again, pointed out, we go through 12 years of government-sponsored education, spend $120,000. Well, what they do is they take these kids who are now adults, who are now citizens, and they give them simple tests on citizenship. For example, if you come to America as an immigrant, you've moved here from the North Pole. I don't even know what America is, but if you're going to be a citizen, I got to take this immigration test. So there's 100 questions on it. This is the minimum every person has to know to be part of the United States. It's the minimum. Well, they took really easy questions off the immigration test and gave it to people who've lived here their whole life. And when they did, 71% of people who've lived here their whole life failed the easiest part of the immigration test. After 12 years in government education, we don't know what it means to be an American. And by the way, they also, for the first time, gave the test to elected officials. 78% of elected officials failed the test. We may have dumb citizens, but we got stupid officials. See, this is thorn bushes ruling. I mean, quite frankly, we're not that smart as people because we refuse to get involved in this stuff and we close our eyes to it and we don't see what's going on. But the people who are ruling us, they know even less about it. Do you know, of those who are holding office right now, 48% cannot name the three branches of government, and they're in office. then how do you do checks and balances between the branches if you don't even know what the branches are? If you don't know the branches, you sure don't know what the checks and balances are, and you sure don't know what the Constitution. But that's what we see. We've got Thornbush's ruling, and that's the problem we've got now. So how do you do that? How do you avoid Thornbush's? How do you get away from Thornbush's as rulers? Well, the Bible gives clear guidance on that. Let me take you to this Bible verse. You have a Bible verse that very clearly tells us what to do in Exodus 18:21. The Bible says, choose out of all the people able men such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. You need to choose out people at the local, county, state, and federal level. Now, it gave you qualifications for office there, but let's just talk about choosing out these rulers, because choose out is an important term there. When you start choosing out, what is it that you're looking for? Where do you find the right leaders that are not thorn bushes? There's a really good answer given to this by Ben Franklin. Take Ben Franklin, and again, we're always told Ben Franklin's the least religious founding father, and he said, you know, if you really want good people for office, he says, the Bible shows us how to have good people in office. He said, look at what God chose for leaders and rulers. And so he goes through, and this is what he quotes. He says, it's observable that God has often called men to places of dignity and honor, to political office, when they've been busy in the honest employment of their vocation. They're already busy doing stuff. They're already, yeah, if you're productive, you're the guy I need in government. You know, I don't want somebody who doesn't know how to run a business or run a family or run. I want people who are already busy doing stuff. And so he points out, he says, notice, Saul was seeking his father's asses and David keeping his father's sheep when they were called to the kingdom. They're already busy with stuff. Their life was full. The shepherds were feeding their flocks when they had their glorious revelation. He said, God called the four apostles from their fishery. They were busy fishing and making a living. And Matthew from the receipt of custom, Amos from among the herdsmen of Tekoa. He says, Moses from keeping Jethro's sheep, Gideon from the threshing floor. He said, God never encourages idleness and he despises not persons in the meanest or the lowliest employments. God's looking for busy people who are already successful at what they're doing. That's the kind of people you want in office. But that's the olive tree, and that's the fig tree, and that's the vine that says, no, no, I'm too busy being productive. Well, see, it's an interesting thing. In this process of choosing out, the way we used to run politics and elections in America, very different from what we do now. You would go into a voting booth with a blank piece of paper and say, who do you want for president? Who do you want for governor? Who do you want for your U.S. senator, for your U.S. congressman? Who do you want for your state rep? Who do you want for your mayor? I'll give you all these options. And so I'll look in there and I'll say, oh, I want John Smith for my mayor. And for city council, I want Sarah Jones. And I'll write down all the names. There was no names on the ballot.
Have you ever wanted to learn more about the United States Constitution but just felt like, man, the classes are boring, or it's just that old language from 200 years ago, or I don't know where to start? People want to know, but it gets frustrating because you don't know where to look for truth about the Constitution either. Well, we've got a special program for you available now called Constitution Alive with David Barton and Rick Green, and it's actually a teaching done on the Constitution at Independence Hall in the very room where the Constitution was framed. We take you both to Philadelphia, the cradle of liberty in Independence Hall, and to the Wallbuilders Library, where David Barton brings the history to life to teach the original intent of our founding fathers. We call it the Quick Start Guide to the Constitution because in just a few hours through these videos, you will learn the Citizen's Guide to America's Constitution. You'll learn what you need to do to help save our constitutional republic. It's fun, it's entertaining, and it's going to inspire you to do your part to preserve freedom for future generations. It's called Constitution Alive with David Barton and Rick Green. You can find out more information on our website now at wallbuilders.com.
Let the torch of freedom burn.
So you write down the names. And then after everybody turns in their ballot, they would tally up all the names. There might be 40 names at a position, but whoever got the most votes for that position, they went to that person and said, okay, the people have said that they want you to be their mayor. You're going to serve? Now, it's interesting that on this philosophy of the people recognizing their own leaders, The founding fathers took a very firm position. It says anybody who puts themselves forward for political office, you need to instantly disqualify them. Anybody who says, I'm your leader, follow me, that's not the leader you want. People recognize their leaders. If I have to tell you I'm your leader, we're in trouble. And so look what people like Sam Adams said on this. Sam Adams said, it bodes very ill to government when men are exalted to places of high trust through their own solicitations or seeking the office. You go out and say, I'm running for this office, that's not a good deal. He continued. He says, he only fills a place with dignity who's invited to it by his fellow citizens from the experience they've had of his adequate abilities. He says, whoever interposes elections with his own seeking of office for himself is to be feared that he will in time become a dangerous party man. He ought therefore to be despised, an intruder. Wow. See, that's what we're filled up with today, people who keep pushing themselves for office. They want to make this their profession. By the way, Noah Webster, who wrote a number of textbooks, also stressed to students, be very careful of people who put themselves forward. This is what he emphasized. He says, as a general rule, it may be safely affirmed that the man who never plots and schemes for office may be most safely entrusted with it. He says, such a man cannot desire promotion unless he receives it from the respectable part of the community, for he considers no other promotion be honorable. Unless the people push him forward, he doesn't want to be there.
We're out of time for today, folks. That was David Barton on biblical principles and the political process. We're sharing with you this week in a four-part series, a new DVD by David Barton. And we got one more day. We'll pick up the conclusion tomorrow. But if you tuned in today for the first time, you can also get part one and part two that you would have missed right there on our website at wallbuilderslive.com. Click on the archives and you'll be able to get the last 2 days as well as today. So that's three of the four-part series. And then tomorrow we'll get the conclusion. Really encourage you tomorrow after the conclusion to take the link to those four parts and send it out to your friends and family. This topic has got to be covered. We've got to get more educated on this. Those of us in the faith community have ignored the political process for way too long based on this lie that those two just simply do not mix, when in fact the Bible has an awful lot to say about politics and how we as believers should approach the leadership in our country. So we want you to be sure and hear that conclusion tomorrow on biblical principles and the political process, but then share it with your friends and family. Don't miss tomorrow right here on Wallbuilders Live.
We stand undivided forever.